The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
On News Talk.
Yeah, Gary O'Hanlon is the executive chef in the K Club, and he is with me for the bookshelf this week, placing his favourite read up there amongst all those others. Last week it was the turn of Nicholas Roach, the cycling legend. Gary, thanks a million for coming in to us.
Good to be here.
Often hard to kind of pick one book above all others, but still it's the task we set people every week. So what book are you putting up on the bookshelf?
I actually had a long hard think about it because I go through periods where I read a lot and then not so much, but Kitchen Confidential was probably the one that jumped out as the all-time favourite, you know, just simply because it just, I don't know, I say it made an impact, like, but it was one of those ones where I couldn't wait to get back home. Like, when I started reading it, it was probably one that I finished in 2 days or 3 days, whereas normally it could take me a lifetime between work and whatnot, like, to get through a book, but Kitchen Confidential was probably the first time I'd read about my own. It's almost as if it was written for me. Like any chef, waiter, or restaurateur, or restaurant owner, it's one of those ones, I suppose, everybody to some extent has a bit of interest in the restaurant game or the food world, which is probably why there's so many shows about food and whatnot. But Kitchen Confidential almost felt like it was like, it's a must read if you've ever worked in the underbelly of the industry, that you would probably recognize lots of different little things from it. It was just amazing, you know.
Anthony Bourdain is who wrote it, and it started with just an article, wasn't it, in the newspaper?
Yeah, he had wrote an article and sent it in to the New York Times, actually, and nothing had happened. I think it might have been his mother or somebody told him to send it in, or a pal or whatever. But then I think they sent it to the New Yorker, and a few weeks or whatever went by, and then out of nowhere the New Yorker published it. It was 1999, and overnight his life changed. He said it himself many times afterwards. He pretty much, like, within a week of it being published, he had signed a book deal, and they got to work then and basically making a full book about the article. So I think The Guardian and a few others actually published the actual piece that, or essay that he wrote initially. But I think it was probably the first time that there was a warts and all. Like, he really, really got...
But his warts and all, like, he talks an awful lot about himself.
It was very autobiographical. Yeah. Like, he was a chef. He was a head chef in Les Halles in New York, you know, and look, there's kitchens in Ireland, there's kitchens in London, kitchens all over the world, Paris. Like, I've worked in a few of these countries, and but there's something very unique about some of these kitchens and high-end cooking lines, especially in New York. Like, if you've ever been in Les Halles, like these places are just so incredibly busy. There's a huge amount of line cooks, they're called, like, in American cities, like, from South America, and they're just absolute unbelievable workers. Like, and, you know, it's a very different world, my world nowadays, to when I started 32 years ago this year. And but definitely, you know, when you're in those dark and dingy kitchens in New York City, like, and Les Halles, I think, might have been near the theater, just so busy. And he talks a lot about, he talks about a sous chef and the relationship that him and a sous chef would have had too. So yeah, it's, and, you know, even parts of it goes into hanging out together, mixing with their families in South America, just the respect that they all had for each other, and on and on and on. And, you know, he was obviously well documented that he was a drug abuser himself, and he had his own demons, and he talked a lot about, you know, using and working and needing cocaine to keep going. And yeah, it was very much, he brought, like, the rock star life that lots of people think about to the fore in that book, you know.
And when you say kind of it's very different today, you know, the life you're living from that, has the industry moved on? Or could you write a similar book today about those places in New York? Are they the same as they were when Anthony Bourdain was there?
Look, they're definitely not the same. Okay. No, like, I think labor laws and different stuff, there's just, it's definitely, no, in saying that, I look across all of my career and, you know, I never remember being in kitchens that were as mental as some of the ones he talked about either, you know what I mean? But then I've got friends that worked in London. Like, London is notorious for some of the, you know, the long days and the mad cocaine fueled way of life in a lot of places.
Would it be in within Europe? London would stand out.
Yeah, London. London's the epicenter of the world. Like the greatest restaurants in the world are in London. Like Paris, the French used to have always maybe had this opinion that they were at the pinnacle of world cuisine or whatever. But London is where the world of food starts.
That's
today.
Interesting.
Probably a close second to that would be New York City, followed by Paris. Or you could flip Paris and New York at any given time. But
and was London always like that?
Yeah, London was always really, really good. It was up there. I mean, you look at the early days of Harvey's and Marco Pierre White getting 3 stars. And, you know, there's loads of wee clips if you follow different accounts on Instagram that shows little video, like basement kitchens and whatnot, and just mad high-end, high-octane cooking. And but, like, it is you're more likely to see chefs now, sous chefs, head chefs and beyond, doing triathlons than what you are doing anything untoward or living mad lives. It's not the norm anymore. It's
Coke for the kitchen, amphetamines for the triathlon. Sorry, you'd burn out. So Kitchen Confidential: Adventures in the Culinary Underbelly by Anthony Bourdain. Did you watch his TV shows? Did you enjoy them?
Yeah, I wouldn't have watched them all, but definitely popped in and out of a lot of them. He was an incredibly intelligent guy. He simplified a lot of things, but he really, really loved food. Like, he was a brilliant storyteller. Chefs just adored him, like, because he earned his stripes as far as most chefs were concerned.
Yeah.
He worked right up until he was quite old. He got his first break in life really, really late in life. So he had earned his stripes as a chef first and foremost. And then, you know, he treated a lot of these far-flung places with the utmost of respect. And I think everybody and anybody that followed him loved that about him, you know?
He has a great kind of philosophy that I often quote, and because it applies to so much else. And he talked about food. He said, really, it doesn't actually matter where it came from, the food, or how it's prepared, or what it looks like. Ultimately, just does it taste good?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And that's true, whether it's a movie, music, a book, whatever you want.
Well, I always say there's 3 things that bring people back to a place, you know, and it's flavour, flavour, and flavour.
That's it. So listen, Pride of Place up there, Kitchen Confidential by Anthony Bourdain. Any kind of special mentions? We often allow people, because it is hard.
How Champions Think by Bob Rotella. I've always loved the correlation, like, and, you know, pro sports people and people in business, or like work ethic and how the mind works, whatever. But Bob Rotella is a very well, highly regarded sports psychologist.
You often hear golfers quoting Bob Rotella.
Yeah, golfers love Bob Rotella for sure. I mean, even shitty golfers like me love him. Do you know what I mean? But I think Park Harrington has actually gone to him many's a time. He often has talked about it. He's worked with LeBron James, a lot of NBA stars. But yeah, golfers would be right up there at, because that is very much a mind over matter career, really. You know what I mean? But he talks about, you know, just how confidence and how you look at yourself, like, and you portray yourself, and basically, like, positive thinking, like the benefits of positive thinking and whatnot, and then you just apply that to your own world and your own life, you know. So that's an unbelievable book, and it's a really good look. There's lots of those kind of self-help stuff I would never touch in a million years, or how to change your life. I've no interest in the likes of that, but there's something just fundamentally sound about how he talks about life, business, and goals, and how to get over failure that really resonates. Brilliant.
All right, it's called How Champions Think in Sports and in Life by Bob Rotella. What are you reading at the moment?
The Fifth Risk, actually. I've read it before, but I think that Trump has gone back into office again. I've actually knocked on the audiobook recently on
all
that
right,
one.
What's that?
The Fifth Risk was an unbelievable read. Michael Lewis, who I've been a big fan of for a long, long time, he would have been the guy that wrote The Big Short, and he also
Moneyball.
Wrote Moneyball. Yeah, he wrote Moneyball as well, which I just have this affinity to Moneyball and the whole thing, you know, like, because you know, that was about the Oakland A's and what they done. And then Fenway Sportsbook, John Henry wanted to make Billy Beane the highest paid manager in history, turned it down. And then Theo Epstein became the GM of the Red Sox. And having lived in Boston for 6 years, I would have followed Theo Epstein's career for a long time. And he was a really, really young GM for a baseball team. But following the Moneyball philosophy, he broke the curse of the Bambino and brought the World Series to Fenway Park in Boston. by literally following that. But the fifth risk is really about Trump's first administration and the inner workings of society, really, and government. It's probably a celebration of civil servants all over the world, really. Like, but Trump just completely and utterly ignored what you're really meant to do in the transition of government. And I think it basically is about the Department of Energy, the Department of Agriculture, and then there's one other I can't think of now. It'll come to me. But in essence, whenever you're trying to become president, you're supposed to put together a transition team. And obviously, you got to raise a lot of money for it.
Yeah.
Trump figures this out, finds out, and he's like going, no. I'm not wasting any of my money on this nonsense. So on the morning after Trump won the presidency, really what generally happens then is his whole transition team will appear at the Department of Energy, the Department of Agriculture, and so on and so forth. And there's what's known as the handover then. Day one comes, nobody shows up. Day two, day three, and so on and so forth. And literally, the day after he wins, he just fired all of whatever team was working with him anyway. He got rid of them all. And it then delves into that story about the inner workings of government, how it's supposed to work, and legally the requirements to run government. But your mouth will be open from start right. to finish in that book. Yeah.
All right. It's called The Fifth Risk by Michael Lewis. But Pride of Place on the Hard Shoulder Bookshelf, Kitchen Confidential, Adventures in the Culinary Underbelly by Anthony Bourdain, Executive Chef in the K Club, Gary O'Hanlon. Gary, always a pleasure.
The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
Weekdays from 4 on News Talk.